You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now, it's over now.
And good afternoon, Richmond. You are listening to The Defenders Live, and I am your host, Anna Edwards. Today is Monday, and this week is Pledge Week. And we are delighted to be here. And don't let anyone tell you anything different about community radio here in Richmond. WRIR rocks. The programming rocks. The musicians rock. The DJs, the engineers, all of the people who are running around this building this week in particular, very visible because we are in the middle of our summer fall fun drive. You need to drop by and check it out. This is a hub of activity, and their whole purpose is to bring you voices and perspectives not otherwise heard. So we're going to jump into our show for today. Defenders Live is brought to you as a production of the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality. And you can learn more at defendersfje.org and defendersfje.blogspot.com. My guest today is a very special guest. Now, all my guests are special because they have to be, right? But today is a very special guest because we have been in cahoots and we have been good friends for a number of years. And Richmond author Gigi Amato has written a spectacular book, and it's called Come August, Come Freedom, The Bellows, The Gallows, and The Black General Gabriel. Gigi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anna. It's great to be with you.
This book has been as long in coming as potentially almost the struggle to reclaim Richmond's African burial ground, I think.
It's, you know, I think you and I probably first talked about the little seed of this book maybe in the early 2000s, 2003 or 2004.
Yeah.
And I kind of can look back over my notes, my research notes, and see I started taking some notes then, and you and I started talking then, and it's a fantastic piece of our history. And you know, I have to say that the work of the Defenders and the NAACP to sort of help our whole community start to think about our own history differently and really, really kind of propelled me forward in the research and thinking about it just as a person who's lived in the region since I was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, we were talking, you know, off the air, and of course we've had lots of conversations about this story. And it is, part of this whole journey has been about raising this story from the dead, raising this story from the hidden places. And so when you talk about there being, you know, other perspectives for revealing the history of Richmond, revealing the Black history of Richmond, one of the key pieces of that becomes that when you have the ability and you assert the ability to tell your story, you inform it, you fill it with a lot of power, depending on, you know, how you tell it and what becomes of it. And some of that you can't know.
Right.
And one of the issues around Gabriel's Rebellion back in the 1800s was, of course, how quickly and ardently the story was suppressed.
Right.
The scale of it, the what it meant to the power structure that existed at that time, what it represented as a threat, what it represented for other people as possibility, and so even I think in the making of this particular story, those issues percolate through that.
I think they do, and I think that's why one of the choices I made. Of course, this is a work of fiction.
Yes.
Right. And there are so many gaps in the history, in the historical, the public record, the public historical record. Mm-hmm. It's sort of framed by maybe a period of two years at the end of Gabriel's life in 1799 and 1800 when he was interacting with the court system.
Right.
And then just a brief mention of him in the public record in 1783 as sort of placing him on Brookfield Farm when he probably would have been about 7 years old. So we have a lot of information late regarding the insurrection. Of course, the filter of all that information is the state.
Yes, right.
Even though what we're able to read at the Library of Virginia is, and online, you know, at the Library of Congress, our trial testimony and trial documents, all of those were written and recorded by folks with an investment in a specific outcome. And I think who were still trying to control the story and spin the story. Some interesting pieces of research that I didn't include as extracts in the book are, you know, all the correspondence that was occurring outside of the official court proceedings between policymakers just trying to figure out what to do. So correspondence between James Monroe and Thomas Jefferson kind of asking, this is getting a little out of hand, you know, what's our best course of action?
Right.
And so it's fascinating to me that as a piece of history, Gabriel's Rebellion has tended to disappear, service backup, disappear in the record. And even early on, it seemed to me as I was doing research early on, as the conspiracy itself was unfolding in 1800, it really did look like the state initially was taking the posture of not telling anyone, of just trying to take care of things quietly.
Yeah, right. That's right. Before we sort of go too far into, because you and I have had lots of conversations.
We know.
We just right up where we left off. We probably should spend a little bit of time just sort of describing the story, the fact that you have taken an historical event and the information that is available to the degree that it is at this point in history. Of course, it's people would have written and did write different interpretations of Gabriel's story in years past.
Right.
To serve a purpose. And so in this instance, one of the things I remember that you first said to me was that you were very interested in exploring what the relationship of Gabriel and Nan would have been in the midst of all of this.
Right. You know, that's really the piece of this history that wouldn't let me go. I kind of tried not to write it because I've never written historical fiction before, and I felt a little in awe of this particular story and a little inadequate. You know, I wasn't sure if I had the skill set to really conduct the research in a good, thorough way. And then with historical fiction, I felt like my obligation to sort of understand and question my own bias was higher than if I was sort of telling my own fiction story. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't sure I had the ability to, because you have to sort of self-reflect and ask yourself, you know, where do I stand in this story and where do I stand today and what does that mean for this fiction?
Right.
But the piece that wouldn't really let me go was the fact that in the trial documents surrounding one of the, you know, one of, if not the largest slave insurrection in the history of the United States, is the fact that the leader, or as they called him in the documents, the chief spring and mover, Gabriel, was married to a woman named Nan. And we only know this from the public record because she was implicated. So, in fact, you know, we see two different people in the trial testimony say that it was Gabriel's wife, Nanny. So I saw some secondary resources that referred to his wife's name as Nancy, and in the trial documents it appears to read Nanny. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if her name really was Nanny or Nancy, so I call her Nan, you know.
And I think that's a people who do genealogy will find that that's a very common occurrence.
Yep.
The names are
they not, change, they initials do. Get transposed,
yes,
exactly.
Yes.
But that's what wouldn't let me go, not only that he had a wife, but that she, from testimony of men who were involved in the plot to pursue their freedom, Nan was implicated as knowing details and recruiting men and telling them what their job would be, and was involved when the insurrection was delayed by a massive sort of catastrophic weather event. We have big words for those weather events now. We see them coming, a derecho, tropical storm.
That's right.
A storm of that magnitude forced them to change their plans and delay until the next night. So trial documents show that Nan was also moving around the countryside, alerting people, right. Don't meet tonight. We'll reconvene right. tomorrow night at the shop.
A key organizer.
She was a key organizer. That's just these two pieces of information revealed to me that she knew enough of the details that she was not only his wife, but his partner, his helper. Right. And then the other piece that kind of illuminated that even more for me is the trial documents seem to suggest that, for the most part, the men involved in the rebellion had been asked not to tell their wives. So right. here she is as the exception. And so combine that with the fact that Gabriel's two brothers, Solomon and Martin, mm-hmm. were also involved in the plan and in the insurrection. They were running bullets and making weapons and recruiting and organizing. For me, it was easy to interpret this as a story about family as well,
right.
and the connection and bond of family, and so that was interesting to me
yeah.
that his wife not only knew about it but supported it and was active in it and had a stake in it, and mm-hmm. he was treating her as a partner. So yeah, that's what I wanted to imagine. It was, you don't need any other motivation. So I didn't feel like I needed any other motivation in the fact that, you know, Gabriel and thousands of other people were enslaved in Virginia. And it was during a time when America was just early off of the revolution. And so it's clear to me that just with the rhetoric and the language that's used in the primary sources, that Gabriel understood the promise of the revolution, and he understood that he had been left out.
Right.
And that a number of people had been left out.
Right.
And that he understood enough about what was happening in the environment that it seemed like an opportunity to move the American Revolution forward and to deliver on the promise.
Right. And I think that's inherent in some of the what appear to be expectations and assumptions about what he would be able to do once they took the city, for example.
Right.
It's as though they thought once they, you know, went to all this effort and, you know, got the governor, you know, in a room where they could make
right.
their case. It wasn't just about, you know, kidnapping and ransoming off, you know, this man for slavery, or it was this idea. And some of this is interpreted, of course, after the fact, but it was this idea that once we get there, it has to become clear that what we are after is what they have
the
already
same thing,
promised.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Even, you know, phrases that show up in the testimony to me do seem to indicate that was the expectation. We will, once we win our freedom,
right.
We will dine with the merchants of the city.
Right.
So
right.
It's, you know, that specific piece reminds me of, I mean, I had the great fortune to visit Haiti years ago in 1990. And it was just before Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected president, and had the great chance to sit down with him at a boys' shelter in Port-au-Prince. And someone among our group asked him, Father Aristide, because he was still a priest at that time, mm-hmm. what is it that Haiti wants? And his answer was, we just want to come up to the table. We want to come up to the table. We're not at the table. We don't want to be under the table like a dog.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to turn the table over. We want to come up to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read that quote in the trial documents that Gabriel had said, at the end of this, when we win our freedom, we will dine with the merchants of the city, that, to me, that connected me right away to sort of the continued global struggle for freedom and equality among all people,
right.
that it's a big, giant table,
yeah,
and there's room for everyone at the table. Not under the table, not turning the table over. We don't benefit from that, but all at the table. So,
right. And it's very interesting, that particular piece of it, too, because we like to go back and imagine what, you know, Gabriel, of course, as an individual, symbolizes this struggle, symbolizes mm-hmm. the rebellion, symbolizes all of the other participants in the rebellion. And, you know, in order to know their minds or have some idea of the conversations and arguments and things that might have gone
yeah.
on during the building of this, because that's inevitable. You know?
Right,
how
right.
do you get that many people on the same page?
And to be quiet, like to keep
for 6 months.
Massively making bullets, making weapons, recruiting.
Right.
But speaking in the code language.
That's right.
But
Yeah, hold that thought.
Okay.
Talk about code language, because I think that's another good one. To let people know that they are listening to The Defenders Live here on WRIR. This is Richmond's radio for the rest of us, 97.3 LPFM. And you can donate today, donate this week. We are in the middle of our summer fall pledge drive. And you can give us a call at 622-9747 and make your donation. And remember, if you didn't hear it at the beginning of the show, Gigi and her publishers have graciously offered 2 copies of Come August, Come Freedom, The Bellows, The Gallows, and The Black General Gabriel. So for the first people to call, first person to call with a $100 or more donation, you will get a signed copy of the first edition of this lovely book. And we have 2 copies, so that means the first and second callers who call in with a pledge of $100 or more. And you will get details on that when you do call in. Again, 804-622-9747. And of course, we encourage you to come visit us. There is food, there are people who are delighted to give you a tour. And if you come while the show is still on the air, although I don't encourage that because you'll miss the show, you can come right after. We might still be here to say hello. So thank you for tuning in. Defenders, the Defenders organization, of course, started the Sacred Ground Historical Reclamation Project in order to begin our engagement of both the reclamation of the burial ground. And the burial ground is key to the story of Gabriel, mm-hmm. because the burial ground was the site of the city's gallows.
Right.
And therefore it was the site where Gabriel and many, but not all, of the conspirators that were caught and tried and found guilty were executed by hanging. And so this site, which represents so many things, also represents the place where, and one of our participants said this, and I thanked her because I thought it put a different spin on what we were talking about, the negativity of calling this place, you know, the place where Gabriel was executed, the place where he died, the place where, but it's also the place where he became our ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
He became he became that person and that symbol, and that he became then the memory that we go back to in order to try to understand what it meant to live a life in those days and live them in the dynamic of, as you describe, the promise of the revolution, but being of the people who were left out
right.
of the promise. And so you were starting to talk a little bit about some of the coded language that was involved in the rebellion, in the organizing of something for 6 months by word of mouth, by foot, by
right.
what are
by,
the networks
by
the, of the day?
The canal, the boatmen on the canals looked like the word had spread up river all the way to Cartersville and down into Norfolk and Suffolk. And so as you read the trial documents, you start to see the men who were involved referring to the rebellion as the business
mm-hmm.
and referring to one another as the boys.
Mm-hmm.
So that you could, on the street or in mixed company, inquire about how recruitment into the insurrection was going
right.
by saying, how are the boys in Manchester?
Right.
The boys in Manchester are ready to do the business. The business is underway.
Yeah.
The boys on the brook are ready. You know, so it was. I encourage everyone really to go to the Library of Virginia, to go online, and read the trial conspiracy, the trial documents of the conspiracy, because it's a pretty fascinating story. It involves families, politics. It was just before the election of 1800, which was a really nasty little election
mm-hmm.
between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. One other interesting thing in the research that I didn't put in the book because this sort of deviated, I wanted the story to be one man's story, the mm-hmm. story of Gabriel and his family.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot kind of going on, kind of off sides, and James Callender, who was a political writer who had been hired by Thomas Jefferson, of course, to sort of slander John Adams in the newspaper and then was thrown into the Richmond City Jail under the Alien and Sedition Act. Sir James Callender was there in the Richmond City Jail while the insurrection was kind of being put down by the state. And as Gabriel's men were being arrested and brought into the jail. So you have James Callender's correspondence to Thomas Jefferson online at the Library of Congress. And so here's an eyewitness account who is not of the jury or the jurists,
right,
writing to Thomas Jefferson, describing the sounds of the jail, sort of passing along hearsay and gossip from the women of Richmond and about the reputation of Thomas Henry Prosser. So it's
right.
Just as a story alone, to me, it's just it was fascinating.
The other person in the story that I want you to talk a little bit about is the other woman in Gabriel's life, in the way that you chose to set up the context for Gabriel's life. And that, of course, is his mother.
Right.
And again, going back to the idea that this is, you know, this is a fictional imagining of what this could have been.
Right.
The choices that you made around the history of the mother and how she brings Gabriel into the world.
Right. Well, thank you for asking about that. I think one of the questions with any book, and certainly with one that's historical and 200 plus years removed from my own experiences, trying to kind of figure out where do I intersect here. And so for me, the way to understand the man, Gabriel, is really through the women who would have had a role that I have in my life as a mother and as a wife. And so, you know, he was born in 1776. That's corroborated by the trial testimony, as well as by Thomas Henry Prosser making a statement to the Richmond paper about how old Gabriel was in 1800. Mm-hmm. And that just seemed like an opportunity to begin to create a fictionalized genealogy for Gabriel that would tie him to many generations past, all the way to Africa, and also tie him to many generations forward. Because one of the things I learned in my research, and maybe I knew it, but just hadn't concretized it. One of the things I learned is that acts of rebellion and acts of resistance were constant among the enslaved community. Constant acts of resistance, small and large. So Gabriel was creating an act of resistance on a grand scale, heralding, whether it succeeded or not, heralding that this change is coming.
Mm-hmm.
But just doing research about the period, you know, you start to see, you know, so many acts of rebellion. So from everyone. Small things related to cooking and cleaning and management of the house and, you know, controlling work schedules and, you know, controlling your own person to the extent that you could.
That's right.
And so what I wanted to do was to create for him, to have him naturally sort of rise up, if you will, from a legacy of generations before him who were both royal,
mm-hmm,
as well as resisting captivity.
Right.
So that's where his mom kind of came into it. So I felt like from a fiction perspective, I needed to do a few things. And so I kind of bookended, framed the novel with the women in his life.
Yeah.
His mother and his wife.
Yeah, I think it's a very it's a compelling framework, and has not really had emphasis before in the public talkings about the story and other interpretations, simply because they've primarily been historical and the data is so limited,
right,
you know, on them. And we're coming on the last minute of the show, and I have a couple other things that I have to say. And so you and I think we'll probably keep talking a little bit,
okay,
after,
great,
we go off the air, because this is a good flow, and then we'll have that available for people. And but I want you to very quickly talk about what's happening on Thursday.
Oh, thank you. Right. So Thursday we'll be at the Poe Museum in Chaco Bottom at 6:30 on Thursday the 20th. Definitely both, you know, to launch the book, but also we're bringing a lot of different people together, including Anna Edwards, really to look at sort of a multimedia interpretation of this story. Nancy Reeves and her students will perform an original folk song, The Ballad of Gabriel. Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy you'll be there with me to really share your portrait of Gabriel and to talk about that. And then we'll have an actor performing a small piece of What Price Freedom, a one-act play that imagines Gabriel in his last days in prison, written by Jerome Scott Smith.
Oh, that's great. That's the African-American
Repertory Theater.
Right. So that's, yeah, this is going to be quite a rich evening. So thank you for joining us on air. And I look forward to continuing to talk and having that available for folks. Thanks, Gigi.
Oh, Anna, thank you. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah. I want to quickly remind people to the Virginia Friends of Mali is having their annual celebration with Grammy Award nominee Sheikh Hamala Djabate and Malian rap star Supernova. This coming Saturday, the 22nd, it's a full day of learning and celebration, as well as a presentation by the ambassador of Mali to the United States, discussing the global security situation in the Sahel region. So I hope that you can join us for that, as well as there's a public forum on October 7th on Iran and Mali and a Defenders public forum on those and one other issue. And so we can check that on the website, defendersfje.org. That's October 7th. And again, there's more there. I want to thank everyone for tuning in today. This discussion has been really rich, and I look forward to continuing it with Gigi. And I look forward to talking to you all next week here on WRIR. And remember to make your pledge. Thanks for tuning in. And remember that kindness does matter. Thanks.
You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now, it's over now.